Palestinians from the northern parts of Gaza, and now they are fighting in the middle of Gaza in Khan Yunis and Gaza City. So Rafah wouldn't be really a red line to them, especially now that we can sense some new kind of language in the U.S. mainly, kind of accepting what is gonna to happen in Rafah, but they are trying, according to them, just to, you know, to decrease the harm against the civilians. So instead of killing, for example, 5,000, they might be looking to negotiate about 2,000. Instead of killing 10,000, they might be looking at, you know, 7,000 or something like this. So in general, Netanyahu is really looking at what his voters are saying, in addition to one of the most crucial issues, which is, you know, something really is recognized by the international community now and by the Israeli analysts, which they are repeating this all the time. The longer war in Gaza against the Palestinians, and probably even to expand it to towards the southern Lebanon, it would be really a very good political move to Netanyahu, because he would keep his political skin.
Yeah, that of course is the argument as far as Netanyahu, that the longer he prolongs the war, the longer he can stay in power, because he has charges against him, corruption charges and all the rest, and so it is in his benefit, to his benefit, to continue with this. But is it sustainable? I mean, surely there should be some acknowledgement that they haven't been able to, despite the fact that they've laid waste to the Gaza Strip and killed so many people, they haven't achieved any of their goals, the most important of which, as they claimed, was to take out the resistance. Yes. And we saw a video earlier on released by Hamas targeting Israeli tanks and taking out their troops in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, I think a lot of this rhetoric may be a facade. So when they say they want to take out Hamas, Hamas is a resistance ideology. You can never take out that ideology, can always resurface. And indeed, for Netanyahu's sake, it is good for him, because at the end of the day, he's using that as a common enemy that the Israeli people have that will enable him, therefore, to wipe out Gaza. Mm-hmm. So the issue, in my small view, is not that he wants to take out Hamas. Hamas is simply a means to annex land, which is what happened to Native Americans, it was what happened to Aborigines, the same colonial mentality. Annex land, extend Israel, and then build on that land and wipe out heritage.
So that's what we heard, sorry to interrupt, the Trump son-in-law, Jared Kushner, saying it makes a great waterfront property.
I know. So the same clip.
And we know that he and Netanyahu are buddies.
Yes. So what I'm saying is that this is all about land and making sure one race is superior and can live in that land. Mm-hmm. That's what I... And so, is that I don't think he's really worried about the political fallout, because if he accomplishes this aim of annexation of land, well, will people forget about the charges? Perhaps. Will the charges be minimized? Yes. Can he use political leverage? Yes. Look at what happened to Tony Blair, George Bush. Same thing.
All about him, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. Let's keep the ball rolling. The death toll in Gaza, of course, is continuing to mount in the absence of a ceasefire deal. Asghar Khan, an independent filmmaker in London, tells us neither Israel nor the Western leaders have any real interest in reaching a ceasefire deal.
I believe the ceasefire has stalled because Israel don't really want a ceasefire. They want their side of the deal to be met for the ceasefire to happen, which is hostages being released, which Hamas has agreed to. But Hamas also wants its hostages/prisoners released who are being detained in prisons without charge. But Israel don't really want to do that. Hamas also want their civilians to return to parts of Gaza and want humanitarian aid through. But Israel don't want to meet that. And that's why the negotiations have stalled. The other reason why the ceasefires have stalled is because the international community, mainly America, Biden, the UK, Rishi Sunak, and all Western leaders, and even Arab leaders, or leaders from all over the world, are not condemning Israel. They are not sanctioning Israel. I mean, they are so powerful. Everyone knows America controls Israel. They created Israel, yeah? And they could go there with their armies and stop Israel from committing genocide, war crimes, apartheid. But they don't want to do that because they have ulterior motives, which is oil, gas. I mean, look, Rishi Sunak and many world leaders have invested in the very companies that many believe now are going to steal the gas from Gaza. So basically, the world leaders are not held accountable for what is being done, yeah? And they need to do more. And if that's not going to happen, what we need is we need new leaders. We need new candidates. We need new MPs and presidents who do care about humanity. Because at the moment, these world leaders only care about the rich elite and themselves. They don't care about the working class people. They don't care about the children starving, the children dying, you know, people using food banks. They just care about themselves.
Askret went on to say that what is needed is a global anti-Zionist movement that will change the oppressed state of the world today.
They are trying to turn us into a totalitarian state now. They are trying to totally control us. And if anyone disagrees with the government or their views, basically they're just going to try and say that you're extremist because they don't want people to fight back against this dictatorship regime that they are trying to enforce on us. To mobilize an anti-Zionist movement, we need to let as many people know as possible what Zionism is about and what Israel are doing, because there are still many people who don't actually know what is going on in Israel and what the Zionists are doing because of the world media and the fact that they control the world media and all the social media platforms. And, you know, we need alternative platforms. We need alternative media. And we need to get the message out there. And we need a new electoral system. We need good people to stand for election and parliament, because these are the people who control our country and ultimately the world. So if we have good people standing for election, independent parties, independent candidates who actually care about the world, that would be the best way forward to achieve this.
The UN Food Agency says famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where over 200,000 people are believed to be experiencing catastrophic hunger. The World Food Program and other UN agencies released a report earlier in the week that says a further escalation of the bombardment, now in its sixth month, could push nearly half of Gaza's population to the brink of starvation.
In northern Gaza, famine is imminent, starting from now till May of this year. So it's a very short window to act. There are about 1.1 million people in catastrophic level of hunger. There are about 854,000 people who are in emergency level of hunger. And then there are about 276,000 people who are in crisis level. So the situation is terrible all along. In the rest of the country, the situation is also really bad, and there is a risk of famine. And that warning goes till July 2024. If there is no cessation to the hostilities, if displacements continue, if we are not able to bring enough food and access people, the report says that there is a famine which could even happen in the rest of the country by July 24.
Let's get some thoughts on those developments within the moments we have left on this episode of Gaza Under Attack. Doctors Imran Ali Panjwani and Nahat Khanfa are still with us. Dr. Khanfa, I'll start with you. What do you make of the restoration of funding to UNRWA, the UN agency? And we know how important the role it plays is, of course, in Gaza and beyond, by countries like Canada, Australia, and yet those other countries who are yet to unfreeze funding to the agency.
It's all about really the internal pressures, because they know whatever the decision they have taken against the UNRWA or the funding of UNRWA was baseless, and they are adopted just stupidly the Israeli narratives without really any kind of evidence. And it was really a big shame, especially they are promoting completely different principles and different different rules in to govern this war. But apparently it seems to be some internal pressures were really mounting on them just to restore the fund given to the UNRWA. I think they tried to convince themselves that this time Israel is promoting something, promoting the truth, but apparently they discovered quite early, I must say, that Israel is just really promoting lies over lies over lies over lies, and this time is not really something different. So this is how I see it, especially that the American administration is trying as well to to moderate their language towards what's happening in Gaza, to put more blame on Netanyahu specifically, seeing the head of the Democrat majority in the Senate saying or using a tough language against Netanyahu. Yeah. I think it's all coming in that direction and that context.
All right, and of course all Chuck right. Schumer, that Democratic majority leader. That takes us to the states, Dr. Panjwani, and countries that are yet to unfreeze funding. The U.S. was first to suspend funding. On the one hand, you have that Washington Post expose saying the U.S. has flooded arms into Israel, more than 100 separate military sales to apartheid Israel since the invasion of Gaza. And then at the same time, on the other hand, you hear the U.S. President, Joe Biden, saying we must get more aid into Gaza. There are no excuses, none. Here in the U.K., arms licenses still to be suspended to Israel. What do you make of all of that?
I think, as I remember when we spoke last time, this is a very common way that when there is war or genocide, in order to achieve democratic aims, you send aid. In order to keep political face, you send aid. So on the one hand, you allow killing, but in a very utilitarian manner. You want to achieve your end despite the destruction. Okay, and if there is people dying, fine, and you try to alleviate that. So the way I look at it, this is no consistent moral principle. This is simply a matter of, well, if there's guilt, you hear the spokespeople of the U.S. presidency speaking that, oh, it's very gut-wrenching, for example, people are dying. Yeah. Well, okay, to satisfy their conscience, they will send aid. They will throw a bit of food there in the air. So yeah,
some of which end up killing people because the
parishes
don't open.
Lack of moral consistency, alleviation of guilt, keeping political face. I don't think there's any genuine relief effort. If people really wanted, then it would be like, for example, Ukraine and people taking in Ukraine refugees. And
there are hundreds of trucks waiting to get in, laden with aid.
Yes, of course.
And the Israeli regime is preventing them from going in.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Our time is definitely up. Our thanks to Dr. Imronali Panjwani and Dr. Nahat Khanfar, and to you for staying with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Is the heart of life pounding? IRIB English Radio.
Through consistent and glaring failures in their coverage, establishment media, including supposedly liberal outlets from the BBC and CNN to The Guardian and New York Times, have smoothed the way for the Zionist regime to carry out mass slaughter in Gaza, what the World Court has assessed as a genocide. Western establishments and their media have been waging a giant campaign of misdirection for the past 5 months, as they have against Palestinians over previous years and decades. Western publics have been encouraged to look in the wrong direction. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East I wrote, hostages tortured to death, parents executed in front of their children, doctors beaten, babies murdered, sexual assault weaponized. This is part of an ever-growing list of documented atrocities committed by the Israeli regime in the 5 months since October 7th, quite separate from the carpet bombing of 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza and a famine induced by the Zionist regime's obstruction of aid. Last week, an investigation by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz disclosed that some 27 Palestinians seized off Gaza's streets over the past 5 months are known to have died during interrogations inside the occupied territories called Israel. Some were denied medical treatment, but most are likely to have been tortured to death. 3 months ago, a Haaretz editorial warned that the Zionist regime jails must not become execution facilities for Palestinians. Israeli TV channels have been excitedly taking viewers on tours of detention centers, showing the appalling conditions Palestinians are kept in, as well as the psychological and physical abuse they are subjected to. An Israeli regime judge recently called the makeshift cages in which Palestinians are held unsuitable for humans. Remember, a large proportion of the 4,000 or so Palestinians taken hostage by the Zionist regime since October 7th, probably the vast majority, are civilians, like the men and boys paraded through Gaza's streets or held in a stadium stripped of clothing before being dragged off to a dark cell in Israel. According to Israeli regime media, many dozens of Palestinian women, including pregnant women, have been seized too, but in their case, off camera. According to United Nations legal experts, Palestinian women are suffering the most degrading forms of abuse at the hands of the Zionist regime's military. The experts observed that Palestinian women and girls in detention were reportedly being subjected to multiple forms of sexual assault. At least two female Palestinian detainees were reportedly raped, while others were reportedly threatened with rape and sexual violence. The Zionist regime troops are also believed to have taken photos of female detainees in degrading circumstances and then uploaded them online. Palestinian women and girls in Gaza are also reported by their families to have gone missing after contact with the Zionist regime army. They said, "There are disturbing reports of at least one female infant forcibly transferred by the Israeli army into Israel, and of children being separated from their parents, whose whereabouts remain unknown." Thank you. A separate report by the UN last week revealed that 21 of its staff humanitarian aid workers had been snatched by the Zionist regime. They were then tortured to extract confessions, most likely false, of involvement in the October 7th events. Their torture included beatings, waterboarding, and threats to family members. Those confessions were cited by Western allies as the grounds, in fact, the only known grounds for cutting off funding to the UN relief agency UNRWA, the last lifeline for Gaza's starving population. It was these claims, extracted through torture, that helped the Zionist regime rationalize its imposing of a famine on Gaza. Of the 1,000 detainees subsequently released, 29 were children, one as young as six, and 80 women. Some were reported to have cancer and chronic illnesses such as Alzheimer's. According to the UN investigation, Palestinians reported severe punishment beatings, being caged with attack dogs, and suffering sexual assault. Physical evidence such as broken ribs, dislocated shoulders, bite marks, and burns was still visible many weeks later. These horrors, of course, are not just taking place in cells and interrogation rooms inside Israel. Gaza is being subjected to astonishing levels of brutality and sadism from the Zionist regime troops, quite aside from the carpet bombing and enforced starvation of civilians. The Zionist regime snipers have fired into Gaza's hospitals, killing medical staff and patients there. The Zionist regime's military has used Palestinians as human shields, including one man sent into a hospital, his hands bound, to announce an Israeli order to evacuate the premises. The Zionist regime forces executed him on his return. Those trying to follow such evacuation orders, waving white flags, have been shot at. Medical facilities have been repeatedly invaded by the Zionist regime military in stark violation of international law. Those who could not be evacuated, such as premature babies, have been left to die unattended, even while Israeli regime troops were occupying the building. Other examples of murderous cruelty are documented daily. Unarmed Palestinians, including those waving white flags, have been shot dead by the Zionist regime troops. Palestinian parents have been executed in cold blood in front of their children. There have been repeated episodes of Israeli regime forces gunning down en masse desperate Palestinians trying to reach aid, as happened yet again this week. And even Israeli regime hostages trying to escape their captors have been killed by the very Israeli troops they were trying to surrender to. These are just some of the cases of Israeli regime sadism and barbarity that have surfaced briefly in Western media coverage, soon to be forgotten.
May 28, 2016 was no ordinary day at the Cincinnati Zoo in Ohio. Something had happened in this old zoo that became the headline of the world's news agencies in less than a few minutes.
Well, what we know is that around 4 p.m., zoo officials say they started hearing people screaming around the gorilla enclosure and then quickly sealed off the area. And this is what they saw when they came on the scene, Renee.
In fact, this incident was related to a gorilla, a 17-year-old gorilla named Harambe, who came to Cincinnati only 2 years ago. Eyewitnesses told about the unwanted entry of a 4-year-old child into Harambe's special enclosure, an enclosure that didn't seem easy to get out of. Tension rose among the visitors as Harambe approached the child. A few moments later, when he moved the boy to another part of his enclosure, tension and anxiety increased even more. 15 minutes had passed from the moment the child entered Harambe's enclosure when the zoo officials made an important decision, firing a series of shots to put an end to that chaotic day.
The backlash after the killing of an endangered silverback gorilla named Harambe at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Tonight, a viral mix of outrage and mourning focused on this 17-year-old endangered silverback gorilla, Harambe.
Harambe lived his life in captivity, and he died through no fault of his own.
The news of this gorilla's death quickly went viral. Reporters arrived at the scene and news agencies covered it. Animal rights advocates voiced their objection and experts challenged the decision of the zoo authorities.
I need to let you know that that gorilla had no intention of hurting that child, and I don't think anybody believes that. However, that gorilla was disoriented, he was agitated, he didn't understand his strength. If you watch that video, you see how he takes that child into the corner. He's trying to get away from the commotion. The child is crying, the people are screaming. This was just a perfect storm of bad situations that ended in tragedy.
Some believe that Harambe didn't intend to harm the child, and others criticized the condition of the fences and, of course, not shooting it with a tranquilizer dot. Those who supported this decision also said that saving a human's life is more important than anything else. Whatever it was, Harambe's death brought up an old issue again. Could humans treat animals as they please? Who was right? Animal advocates or zoo officials?
So as a result, a number of social media pages have opened up using the hashtag RIP Harambe. You can see that from this Facebook page. And lots of people also very upset because these animals could easily live up to 40 years. And he was only 17. In fact, Harambe celebrated his 17th birthday just on Friday. Lots of questions about the zoo's behavior, the family's behavior, the parents in question, and whether this is the right way to tackle a situation like this.
Ancient petroglyphs prove that the relationship between humans and animals is as old as human history. A relationship that includes hunting, taming, and sometimes entertainment. It was the year 2009 when archaeologists discovered an amazing area in Egypt. The area dates back to 3500 BC, an area full of elephants' bones as well as rhinoceros, all kinds of monkeys and felidae, which was apparently built for keeping animals. This important discovery confirmed that Egyptian pharaohs were the first to build something similar to a zoo. Of course, the tradition of keeping animals existed in other parts of the world as well. Regions like Greece, Rome, Babylon, Iran, China, India, and Africa. In addition, European kings were very fond of animals. Charlemagne had received an elephant as a gift from the Abbasid caliphs, and Henry III had several lepers in his palace. In addition to these cases, European sailors also brought exotic animals as souvenirs from their exploratory journeys, animals that made the collection of kings richer and provided entertainment for them. Until the beginning of the 18th century, only kings could have their own collection of animals. But a little later, the situation changed.
If you peel it all back and you look at, say, London Zoo in 1828 and all the other zoos throughout the 19th century, they all had big animals, showy animals, colorful animals, mainly from Africa or from Asia. Typical zoo today has got exactly the same collections. They have not moved on from that.
The importance of scientific studies led to the creation of the first zoos with today's shape and form. Educating people and spreading knowledge was the goal of their establishment, and academic centers financed them. Schönbrunn Zoo, which is considered the oldest zoo in the world, is one of them. A zoo which was founded in 1752 in Vienna, Austria, to gradually be used for scientific purposes. Visiting zoos like Schönbrunn was free at first, but it didn't last long. Shortly after its establishment, the visitors' interest made the owners of this zoo think of generating income. It was for this reason that scientific purposes were gradually sidelined and zoos around the world were added day by day. Newly established zoos in London, Paris, and Berlin started a tough competition. Competition in displaying more exotic species and attracting people's attention more and more. Of course, very soon, attracting the attention of visitors led to other aspects too. For people in the mid-19th century, more interesting than mammals, reptiles, and birds were aquatic animals. In fact, until then, there was not much information about the underwater world. Therefore, exhibiting aquatic animals could generate a lot of revenue. But there was also a big problem. Transferring aquatic animals to land and keeping them was not an easy task. At first, a lot of attempts were made by Jean Villeprot Power and Richard Owen, but this problem was solved by someone else, English naturalist Philip Henry Goss. Goss proposed the idea of the aquarium by writing a book about the wonders of marine life. His glass cube opened a window to the unknown world, a window that could be a small branch of the magic of the sea before humans' eyes. Henry Goss's aquarium idea was immediately welcomed. It stepped beyond the boundaries of scientific studies and became popular. All of a sudden, there was a huge demand for having a home aquarium, a demand that brought a piece of the sea to the people's homes and was a source of pride for its owners. A little later on, shops related to this profession were established one by one. The construction of aquariums progressed rapidly, and larger samples of it reached zoos. Of course, in the meantime, Philip Henry Goss was depressed. Suddenly, he realized what a disaster the aquarium idea would lead to. A tragedy that was a great sorrow to him. Gus's distress was real. During the last century, aquariums' fever has harmed the pristine nature of the seas. Traders of this industry go down to the seas every day to take possession of its flora and fauna. Catching aquarium fish is so extensive that there are no accurate statistics of it. But it can be said that there are more fish than cats and dogs in the US and Britain. Nowadays, the aquarium industry has its own events, magazines, and customers. Customers who spend huge sums of money annually on their interest. But this is only one side of the story. The other side is the harm inflicted upon the marine environment. Fishermen in Southeast Asia use sodium cyanide to anesthetize fish, a dangerous and deadly substance for corals and invertebrates. In addition, a large number of fishes die in the fishing process. A strange statistic says that out of every 10 fish that are caught for aquariums, only one fish reaches its destination. A destination that is either gorgeous home aquariums or available samples in zoos. Visitors walk in these beautiful and colorful corridors, but they don't know much about the fishing process. Currently, the number of annual visits to zoos in the world has reached 600 million people. People who are willing to pay a high price to watch 2 million captive animals in these cages. A price that these unfortunate animals pay in another way.
Wildlife tourism is a massive industry, accounting for 10 to 20% of the global tourism industry. People go on vacation and pay money to either view or interact with animals. I don't think we can ignore the role that social media plays. The sheer number of people now not only posting their travel experiences, but consuming others' travel experiences means that these things are spread in an instant with the click of a button. But the issue with wildlife tourism is most people have absolutely no idea of what goes on behind the scenes.
The first issue that environmental activists object to is the concept of captivity of different animal species. This captivity may save human lives, but it has a negative effect on animals. Not being free makes these creatures nervous and mentally ill, something that will lead to unusual behaviors a little later. Constant walking or sitting for long periods of time, injuring itself or other animals, or doing a repetitive, frenzied act. The limited space of the cages makes the suffering of this captivity harder and aggravates the nervous diseases. Spaces that are designed far smaller than the natural needs of these creatures.
Elephants are a notable example. In the wild, they walk up to 50 miles a day. Yet in zoos, these social and cognitively complex animals are confined in enclosed spaces where they can suffer from arthritis and joint pain. A study on African elephants showed that the average lifespan of African elephants in European zoos is less than 17 years. which is less than half the average lifespan of African elephants who are killed by poachers in the wild. And when the study looked at African elephants not affected by poaching, their average lifespan was 56 years in the wild, or more than three times as long as those kept in European zoos.
In recent years, delphinariums have been criticized more than any other complex. The colorful decorations and cheerful appearance of these centers are designed only to attract customers, the appearance behind which lies the suffering of dolphins. The problem of these aquatic animals is more than the limited space for living. They are forced to learn humans' favorite behaviors by starvation or physical punishment. They were forced to work beyond their capacity and do things that are against their nature. Dolphins are animals that need to live in groups and freely. A habitat free of limitations with food always within reach. But delphinariums keep them away from their kinds. A move that will cause both depression and fatal physical diseases such as stomach ulcers.
No. Whales and dolphins, you've got to give them a very extensive area. You can't really have a conventional zoo with whales and dolphins with good welfare. Elephants don't do well in zoos and shouldn't be kept in zoos, partly because of the way they're trained, because they generally have to be trained as well, and elephants are trained in using extremely harsh methods throughout the world.
But the only problem of zoos is not keeping animals from their natural living conditions. On the other hand, intentionally or unintentionally, many animals are poisoned in zoos, sometimes by the strange foods of the visitors, and sometimes by rotten or inappropriate meals. They may starve for many hours on holidays. They may not receive timely and effective veterinary treatment due to illness. The saddest thing is when an accident happens in the zoo. Humans can run away from earthquakes, fires, or other incidents, but what will happen to caged animals? Another side of the animal's vulnerability is the control of their reproduction by humans. Fertility of animals at zoos is generally associated with a lot of control, and in most cases, it ends in their sterilization. Of course, the animals that survive sterilization will face a worse fate. They are forced to have babies irregularly. Babies who will soon be sold at exorbitant prices in the black market. Some estimates put the turnover of this business at $23 billion a year, a number that is largely the result of illegal and clandestine activities in official zoos. But official and well-known zoos are only part of the story.
I breed more tigers than anybody in the country.
Breeding was his whole thing. The whole idea was to keep baby tigers being born. Joe had so many animals that he sold them to a lot of these little animal parks around the country.
But if I wanted to just buy a regular baby tiger from a breeder, how much would it cost?
$2,000. Now keep in mind, it's illegal now.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is offering humanitarian aid to a population it has helped to devastate. The hypocrisy is breathtaking. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East IROAD, since Arab and Western countries, including the U.S., began airdropping aid into Gaza, we have wondered, why are they not using land routes as thousands of trucks stacked with vital humanitarian supplies sit on the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing? According to a February report from Al Jazeera, aerial and satellite footage showed more than 2,000 aid trucks waiting to cross at Rafah. And why are these aid drops coming 5 months after the Zionist regime launched its war on Gaza? While this might seem like a humanitarian effort, at first glance, there appear to be ulterior motives at play. Since the war began last October, international appeals have mounted to bring life-saving aid to besieged Palestinians in Gaza. But neither these appeals nor the horrifying video footage that has emerged of starving civilians has moved neighboring countries to stop the Israeli regime atrocities that have killed more than 31,000 people and created conditions of widespread hunger. The Zionist regime's strategy entails asserting absolute control over the humanitarian conditions in Gaza. Why would it agree to airdropped aid while obstructing the delivery of vital goods via land, the latter which would be much easier and cheaper? Regardless of the method, the Zionist regime insists on inspecting all aid that enters Gaza by opting for airdrops and sea bridges instead of utilizing the Rafah land crossing. The Tel Aviv regime is sending a message that Cairo's control over the border area is merely symbolic, while the real levers of power are with the Zionist regime alone. The use of airdrops, especially from Arab countries, also highlights the shortcomings of Arab and American efforts to alleviate the suffering in Gaza. Instead of applying pressure on the child killer regime of Israel to open the Rafah crossing, they have circumvented its refusal by launching a more complex, dangerous, and expensive aid operation. The fabricated regime of Israel routinely uses the media in an attempt to enhance its image and create the perception of humanitarian in times of war. By showcasing aid planes, it diverts attention from the situation at Rafah and aims to dilute public criticism. But it is crucial to critically examine such narratives and manipulations. By ensuring the continuing closure of Rafah, Gaza's sole gateway to the outside world, the Zionist regime further isolates the territory's Palestinian residents. The airdrops it has allowed, meanwhile, have been disorganized, random, and ineffective, failing to address the logistical challenges of aid distribution. The airdrops even turn deadly when parachutes fail to deploy and the boxes hurtle towards Gaza, killing five Palestinians who had been eagerly awaiting the delivery of much-needed relief. As one friend in northern Gaza said, "With us being killed, even with the airdropping, we have experienced all forms of death." As the international community comes together to support the people of Gaza, it is crucial to prioritize the safety and dignity of those in need. We have been pushed to the brink, a paltry symbolic aid drop with no plan for its safe distribution does not help Palestinians, but rather deeply humiliate the people of Gaza. Those seen in video footage running towards the airdrops come from all walks of life, including doctors, engineers, and academics. Palestinians are being degraded and then thrown bits of food for millions of hungry mouths. There is a much easier solution. The Zionist regime must immediately open all land crossings into Gaza.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In our program today, we shall take a glance at how Islam impacted on the culture and arts of some of the eastern and western parts of the continent.
The impact of Islam on African culture and art.
Any discussion on Islam in Africa brings to mind a major historical fact. The first journey in the history of Islam was the migration of Muslims to Abyssinia in eastern Africa and the present-day Ethiopia. During the advent of Islam, the polytheists persecuted the Muslims, those who proclaimed belief in one God and God's messenger, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his progeny.
This resulted in Prophet Muhammad's suggestion to Muslims to leave Mecca and seek protection in Abyssinia. According to historians, Najashi, the king of Abyssinia, welcomed the Muslim refugees from Mecca into his kingdom. The Muslim migrants in Ethiopia built the first mosque in Africa, known as the Al-Najashi Mosque, in the 7th century. Najashi is considered to be the earliest Muslim settlement in Africa.
Taleb Rifai, a former Secretary General of the United Nations World Tourism Organization, says this mosque in Ethiopia is part of the history of the advent of Islam.
These are the beginnings of the story of Islam that spread to the entire world. But it's also important for all faiths of all people from all over the world. This is a lesson in tolerance and understanding and compassion. It's a lesson that we should learn from today. People receiving people that are in need, helping them, supporting them, and making them move forward.
Now, in the first part of our program, we shall focus on the impact of Islam on the culture and art of the people of Eastern Africa. To discuss this, we have contacted Professor Abdul Sharif. He's a distinguished Tanzanian scholar of history. He has also played a crucial role in preserving Zanzibar's cultural heritage. Now, Professor, the first migration of Muslims is a period in which early Muslims fled the persecution of the Quraysh tribe in the Arabian Peninsula into Abyssinia, or modern-day Ethiopia. Now, how did this migration impact on the spread of Islamic culture in Eastern Africa?
The fact that this was the first migration of Muslims outside Arabia, that becomes very significant because as far as Zanzibar the Swahili coast, people like to claim that, in fact, the people, the Muslims who came, they came to Zanzibar rather than Ethiopia. And I think this sometimes is sort of local beliefs, but there are claims here in Zanzibar itself that that Islam reached Zanzibar before it reached Medina. And there is even a mosque here which is said to have been built a very long time ago, which I think some of this might be overexcitement about it. But it shows really how high Islam is held, particularly by the people in Zanzibar, because Zanzibar is 97% Muslim.
For over 1,000 years, Swahili people, who are known as the Waswahili, have been living along the East African coastal land extending from the north coast of Kenya to the southernmost part of Tanzania. The Swahili people are also the inhabitants of several nearby Indian Ocean islands, including Zanzibar, Lamu, and Pate. Most of the Swahili people are Muslims. They became Muslim through the influence of people coming from the north and also from across the Indian Ocean. Islam has greatly influenced the language, art, and culture of the Swahili people. Omar Bwana, a Kenyan museologist, says the history of East Africa is well documented.
The first recorded history like this, Papyrus of Eritrea, is a trade book showing about the East Africa and is well documented.
East Africa is home to Swahili, an official language of Africa. The interaction of Muslims with East Africans greatly impacted on the language and culture of this region.
I think actually when you mention the word Swahili, you should know the origin of that word. It comes from, of course, the Arabic word Sahel, which means the coast. Now, the coast, it is a very simple concept. You know, we think the coast is a coast. But when you think historically, the coast is where the continent meets the sea. There is an area of intersection between these two worlds. And it is not merely the sea, the water of it, but it is the countries beyond it. In other words, the Swahili coast is very uniquely an area of interaction between Africa and the whole Indian Ocean world for a very long time. Historically, we know at least 2,000 years of interaction that people have been coming and trading and interacting. Now, when people interact, they need to have a common language. And very often it is sort of pidgin languages, a mixture of both languages so that people can understand each other. But in the process, each language absorbs some of the words which are useful, which they didn't have before. And so some of these words began to be absorbed into Kiswahili.
Lamu Old Town in Kenya is the best preserved Swahili settlement in East Africa. Now, the Islamic architecture of this town, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is characterized by the simplicity of structural forms, enriched by such features as inner courtyards, verandas, and elaborately carved wooden doors. Now, the town is also considered a spiritual cradle of the Swahili language. Mohamed Mwenje is the site manager of the Lamu Old Town World Heritage Property in Kenya, gives us a glimpse of Lamu Town.
Lamu is credited as one of the best preserved Swahili old towns on the East African coast. It is a place like no other. It is a peaceful, beautiful tropical island where life is lived at its own rhythm. It is a town whose history is as mysterious and fascinating as the winding streets of the medieval stone town. For the would-be traveler, Lamu is a hypnotically exotic experience, made even more enjoyable by the relaxed and welcoming attitude of the locals.
Now, Lamu has maintained its social and cultural integrity. Now, this historical town has also retained its authentic building fabric up to the present day. Professor, can you tell us more about